From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present a previously recorded episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank's guest is Noel Mehring, author of Awake, Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology. And here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, the podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And today will not be a disappointment. This is one of the most important podcasts I have ever done. I think this goes to the essence of civilization. I've often said that the foundation of civilization is life. And then you can build on that foundation. There are three main pillars, the pillar of church and government and marriage. But this gets to an even more granular issue, the issue of what it means to be human. And my guest today discusses this as poignantly and powerfully as anyone who has ever addressed the subject. That is my personal fervent opinion. You know, Karl Marx once said that religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature. It's the heart of a heartless world. It is the soul of soulless conditions. And then he said the abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is to call on them to give up a condition that requires illusions. The criticism of religion is therefore in embryo, the criticism of that veil of tears of which religion is the halo. Again, that's Karl Marx. He's talking about what he envisioned, the fall of Western civilization, much like the fall of the Roman Empire. And let me just say as prologue to introducing my guest, that we failed to stand when marriage was being redefined. We capitulated. We dare not fail with respect to the cult of wokeism. And that is the subject for today's Hank Unplugged. My guest is Noel Mehring. She holds an MA in philosophy. She is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. She writes on culture, politics, religion. And she's the co-author of Theology of Home. But to the point of this podcast, she is also the author of Awake, Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology. And Noel, I am really delighted to have you on the podcast. When I say I haven't seen anyone codify the essence of this subject as well as you have, I mean that with total integrity and sincerity. I think you've just done a brilliant job in this book. And I hope people will get the book. It's available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. But anyway, welcome.
Thank you. It's a delight and real honor to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's an honor to have you. Can you start by just defining what we're talking about when we talk about woke or wokeism? It seems to be part of our vocabulary now, and I'm not sure that people understand what it means in precise terms.
Well, I think that maybe a lot of people would define it sort of innocuously as the state of being alert and attuned to the various layers of oppression in society surrounding race, gender, sex, sexuality. And I think that just based on sort of that kind of simple definition, a lot of people think, well, that sounds right. You know, that sounds like something that, you know, a compassionate person should align himself with. But, you know, I think a lot of people have been realizing, particularly over the last couple of years, that there's something fundamentally off about the movement, that there's a connection between, you know, racial justice that also wants to queer the culture and disrupt the nuclear family and What unites the ideology in wanting to achieve both those goals? Why are they connected? And I think they are intrinsically connected. I think it is, you know, a real ideology, true to form, meaning that it takes partial truths and totalizes them. So it takes something that is true and starts with that, you know, and there's an injustice here. Let's look at this world purely through this filter of oppression, power, defining every human person to division as either a perpetrator or a victim, and then create moral stature based on the side of victimhood. And in that division, you kind of lean into it, raise people's consciousness about that, and then ultimately target God as the ultimate oppressor. I think he is the final target of the movement. He oppresses us, according to the movement, through the mere fact of the moral law, through any type of objective good that we should correspond our lives to, and by limiting our ability to deify ourselves by creating our own self-narrative in defiance of bodily reality, moral norms, and any sort of stabilizing force or institution. So I do think it is an ideology that's totalitarian in its essence, atheistic in its essence, as you were indicating in your earlier remarks about Marx, and also very postmodern, utterly destructive. It can only destroy, it cannot construct. And I think we're seeing the rotting fruits of that all over our society now.
Yeah, so you've touched on this, but there's a linguistic characteristic to this ideology. It's a manipulation of words. We've written in the past about the word crisis that threatens to undo Western civilization. Can you expand on that a little bit, the linguistic crisis that we're facing?
Yeah, well, it, you know, really reveals the slip of the, I think, the demonic aspect throughout this, that it takes sort of, you know, the word of God, the logos, the word made flesh, that the word creates the world, that he creates the world, that we have an author. And it inverts us by deifying ourselves, that we can kind of proclaim into the world what is real based on how we self-create it, how we create it. We can speak new realities into the world. So that's a very postmodern idea that words ultimately have power, that truth and knowledge are just functions of power. And so whoever can define the terms, whoever can define what is real, and whoever can control language is the one who has the power. And so ultimately, the woke movement is going to turn words into both something that can harm us and hurt us. If someone mispronounces me, for example, or deadnames me, then that is something that fundamentally has stripped me from my dignity, has violence, according to the movement. But it's also, words are also a bludgeon. They're, you know, a hammer. They're something that we can use to destroy normativity and stabilizing forces. So I think insofar as they become so powerful, it's a sign of how weak we become, that someone can fundamentally do violence to me by not using the pronouns that I pick, for example. I mean, it just shows kind of the instability of the ideology, that if you are confident that you're proclaiming something that's true, you invite disagreement, you invite dissent. It's not a threat to you. It's not an existential threat to your position. But the movement has really inverted that because it's so built on a fundamental lie. I think that's why the control and the coercion of other people's assent to our beliefs become so crucial. And that oftentimes manifests itself by mandating the language that supports the ideology, because that in speaking something that's true, in dissent of it, you really fundamentally undermine the entire construct of the ideology.
And that's why you say it has cult-like characteristics.
Yeah, it's coercive in that way, right? Cults don't tend to allow dialogue and dissent. It tends to be a very coercive, uniform sort of force, you know, for its adherents.
There's so much in your book that struck me. You talk about woke Christianity, and I have a quote here from your book. You're quoting Nadia Boltz-Weber, the author of Shameless, who says that she's calling for a Christian sexual revolution and promoting the notion that everything from transgenderism to feminism stands in accord with God's will.
Yeah. Yeah. So she was an interesting figure. I just had seen, you know, acquaintances, maybe former, I went to a Christian college and friends from college who all were kind of becoming fans of hers in particular. And she certainly is striking when you see her initially. She's a woman wearing a collar and she's got tattoos. And, you know, and then she's saying things like that, you know, that we need a new sexual revolution. She makes fun of St. Augustine. You know, certainly she thinks of the church, traditional sexual normativity as being deeply oppressive, and sees herself as her mission being only and merely to love, right? Then that love demands of us full acceptance and affirmation, particularly, I think, of the ways that we can be transgressive sexually. You know, and that's really a very strong tenet of this sort of neo-Freudian kind of element, that our freedom comes from finding the unique ways that we might be able to transgress moral codes in sexually. So she kind of became a poster child in my mind for Christianity that was moving in that direction. I think that we have been, you know, for quite a while, various churches and figures and pastors, but she really sort of fully embraced it and was owning it in a way that seemed different and new and was also compelling to more people than I would have imagined it to be. So I thought it'd be interesting to put her front and center and just say, this is, you know, this could be a potential future of the church and many churches if we don't start analyzing this and calling it out.
Stay right there, because we'll be back soon to rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Noel Mehring. The long-simmering crisis that grips our culture has exploded in recent years, leaving us divided and intransigent. Discourse seems futile when we are no longer a people with shared principles or even a shared understanding of reality. What seems obvious to one person is patently absurd to the next. The collapse of meaning is not accidental. It has been plotted and documented for decades and now presents in its current form as woke ideology. Awake, Not Woke by Noel Mehring unmasked this ideology by examining its history, major players, premises, and tactics, showing us that wokeness is at its core an ideology of rupture. Indeed, it is an ideology with fundamentalist and cult-like characteristics that is on a collision course with Christianity. To receive your copy of Awake, Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Breaking the code of the Book of Revelation has become an international obsession. The result has been rampant misreading of Scripture, bad theology, and even bad politics and foreign policy. In the Apocalypse Code, find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. Hank Hanegraaff argues that the key to understanding the last book of the Bible is the other 65 books of the Bible, not current events or recent history. The Apocalypse Code offers sane answers to some very controversial questions, such as, what does it mean to take the book of Revelation literally? Who are the Antichrist and the Great Whore of Babylon? And what is the real meaning of 666? Order The Apocalypse Code by Hank Hanegraaff today. Available in softcover, MP3 CD, or MP3 download from equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI.
Truth Matters, Life Matters More details Hank Hanegraaff's personal pilgrimage from his long defense of truth to his discovery that life matters more. Essentially two books in one, Part 1 equips Christians to defend the essential truths of the historic Christian faith. Part 2 explains why truth is necessary, but hardly sufficient. That the map is not the territory, the menu is not the meal. We are created to experience life to the full through union with God in Christ. Is there more to the Christian life than what you are experiencing? Truth Matters, Life Matters More unveils the unexpected beauty of an authentic Christian life. To receive Truth Matters, Life Matters More for yourself or as a terrific gift to a friend or loved one, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us online at equip.org.
The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources, along with a complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal, are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. hankhanna.org. Here again are Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Noel Mehring, as they continue their conversation.
I want to kind of work through your book a bit. You start in part one with origins, so that begs the question, how did we get here? How did we get to this era of wokeism?
Yeah, well, I go through the history. I mean, I start in this, you know, snake in the garden, cajoling the first woman that we might be as gods. And I think that is where it begins, as most sin does. Or all sin does. But historically, you know, most people point to Karl Marx. I think it's also really interesting and important to think about and understand Hegel, who Marx was greatly influenced by. I think that's where we get a lot of the language that we don't even think twice about now, which is such as, are we on the right side of history? That's a really Hegelian statement. This idea that society develops and discovers itself all moving towards some perfect utopian endpoint, and that that endpoint we are going to be judged by now. And so it kind of creates this inability to have a limiting principle in our movement of progress, because every time you progress a little bit more, well, you're going to be old fashioned in a minute, you know, if you don't keep progressing. And as you were saying earlier, you know, I think a lot of Christians thought, well, we can stop. We'll just give them gay marriage. You know, we'll redefine marriage and then, you know, then we'll stop there. Well, it was never going to stop there because it doesn't limit itself. It has to move on to the next thing. And once you've dismantled any intelligible meaning of marriage, then there's no reason why you should limit that to just the same gender. It should not be limited by number anymore, for example. So I think Hegel, that really comes from Hegel. That sort of Marx was very influenced by that kind of conflict theory moving towards a utopian state. And that sort of revolution through time is going to be in some ways inevitable. He took it to a materialist level purely. He did away with Hegel's sort of attachment to rationalism and the absolute spirit. But when the revolution did not come about, there were a group of Marxists that were left frustrated. They thought it was inevitable. The proletariat, the working class, just had to realize how miserable that they were, and then they would revolt, and we'd be moving closer to a communist state. So when it didn't happen, they formed an Institute for Social Research and matriculated to the United States around 1935, welcomed by John Dewey at Columbia University, came to be known as Frankfurt School. And they were really brought with them a convergence of neo-Marxism, also neo-Freudianism. And so there you see the seeds of the woke movement. My liberation is by triumphing over oppressive groups outside of myself, but my liberation is also by triumphing over my own internalized instinct to repress my more transgressive desires. So through that convergence, they just realized what we have to do is seed the institutions of culture. This is also Antonio Gramsci's idea, that we have to, as we can, it's going to be a long march through the institutions. As we place the seeds of revolution into the powerful institutions, law, academy, Hollywood, popular culture, art, education, make all of these, turn activists into in through all these institutions. That is how we will seed revolution in the West. So the West was really resistant to revolution because we had strong understanding of family ties. We have a strong Christian background history and animating us even still. And that we believed and respected in the authority of fatherhood, you know, that we understood that to be a beautiful thing. And so you can see how, if you even think about even in just isolating popular culture, I think we all joke about how TV shows have all become, you know, mockeries of fatherhood. You know, the father's the bumbling idiot or the oppressive preacher who with a wife who's a doormat. But those narratives actually really do affect us, I think, deeply. And Frankfurt School guys knew that. They would say, you know, exaggerate reality. Your job in creating art is not to reflect what is real so much as it is to exaggerate what the oppressive narratives in order to raise people's consciousness. And I think that's been really effective. We are very affected by stories. You know, we're people who, you know, look and watch, you might watch enough compelling movies that give you us one narrative and start to look at our lives as though this is around every corner. This is what we see in our neighbors, what we see in ourselves. We become suspicious once that archetype of the, you know, fatherhood, for example, is kind of dismantled in our minds. So I think it was far more effective than we understand. I mean, even if you think about the feminist movement, so Marcuse really understood that the feminist, burgeoning feminist movement in the 60s was something that could be exploited to turn something that is maybe oriented around, you know, kind of arguing for, you know, the, well, historically the suffragettes or some things that, you know, are arguably fine and good and just. But we can lean into this division and create a deeper division, a deeper divide, and train them to realize that there is no ability to right this institution, that it has to actually be destroyed. This marriage has to be destroyed, smash the patriarchy, you know, that there's some institutional ways in which men have run society that is utterly poisonous, are utterly poisonous. So it became this force for utter destruction in multiple ways, not just through art and popular culture, but obviously I think we're seeing it largely through the academy and through media as well, and law, and now medicine. So I think it's been effective and we're seeing that now, but it was, you know, also the postmodern movement is important. I go into that a little bit, as we talked about earlier, that it was really added, sort of put on steroids, everything that's already happening and ruining kind of any possibility of having common narratives, common historical shared understandings of the goodness of, you know, our country, our having a patriotism that is something that's admirable and not something that is naive or ignorant. And insofar as those narratives have become destroyed, I think we've lost a lot of ability to have a brotherhood of man, to have, you know, common citizenship, to have family history, to have heroes, you know, all of these icons that I think really unify us have been taken from us. And that was largely the leading into the woke movement.
You talk about marching through the academy, and your book does such a good job of explaining how we're training teachers and people on all levels of the societal ladder in critical theory. So people hear about critical theory, either CT or critical race theory, CRT, and oftentimes can't identify precisely what we're talking about there. And I think this is the heart of the issue. And this is now overwhelming, certainly the educational environment, the environmental system, the entertainment system, et cetera. This has really taken hold, and there's a narrative around it that seems to stick.
Yeah. You know, I mean, a writer once said that critical theory is basically criticizing something until you destroy it. And I think that that's as simple as any other. I think oftentimes we confuse critical theory with critical thinking. And so people who are trained to do critical thinking will think that they're having a conversation based on critical thinking. They don't realize that, you know, I'm trying to dialogue, you're trying to dominate, right? So as I indicated earlier, or touched upon a bit, the critical thinker, the end of dialogue is truth. You want to arrive at the truth. And so if you are off in some way, or if you don't have the full picture, you want someone to point that out. You invite criticism, you invite objections, because if you want to arrive at the truth, then that's only helpful to your purpose. For the critical theorists, the goal is not truth. The goal is power, domination. And so you don't invite objection. Rather, you want to silence objection. And this is rife throughout the literature. So Marcuse wrote a pivotal essay called Repressive Tolerance. And this is echoed by Robin DiAngelo and Ibram X. Kendi and contemporary woke figures, that the goal is not to hear equal sides. We don't want to hear, give you a voice and then give this other side a voice. We actually want to silence the dominant voices that have plagued society. And so I think we oftentimes will say, you know, you'll have people who are of the older school saying, well, this is such hypocrisy. I'm not giving, you know, they're not hearing, they're not dialoguing, they're not hearing both sides. But that's not the point. I think the point isn't hypocritical. It's, as someone else said, it's hierarchical, that this is a new structure of dominance where some people will be platformed and some people will be deplatformed. And that's the way the ideology works. And critical race theory is just that sort of neo-Marxism applied to race. Critical gender theory is it applied to gender. But it's the same animal. It's about raising people's consciousness to oppression and ultimately destruction.
You talk in the book about dogmas. It's part two of your very insightful book. What are the primary dogmas of wokeism?
Well, the three things I distilled it down to are three sort of distortions. The first one being an emphasis on group over person. So that's the collectivist mindset that I'm only valuable or I'm not valuable as an individual. I'm valuable insofar as I might further an ideology. I'm a totem of a group, right? So we see this with the way in which, for example, a conservative Black man won't have a voice, right? He won't be uplifted because it's not about supporting him as a racial minority. It's about supporting someone who will support the ideology. It's political far more than personal. This creates a society where you have that instinct to proclaim a victim status in order to say that you have moral stature. That's what gives you a voice. And I think we see this all over the place. I mean, you know, we can even have instincts in ourselves that, you know, it's so ubiquitous now that sometimes, you know, we might find ourselves thinking, well, how have I been hurt and how might that give me a platform to speak from which to speak? It's become ingrained in us, I think, in large part. So that group over person is the first one. But the second one I call will over reason. It's will over reason or will over nature, which are connected. So the idea that we have a stable human nature, meaning that our nature has a purpose. We have a purpose to our bodies. There's a purpose to our fertility. There's a purpose to sexuality. That there's an intelligibility to how we were created. And that speaks to something about where our flourishing might lie. And that intelligibility, so that's bringing the reason in. And the movement will say that we know we don't prioritize reason in the old sort of like ancient Greek understanding that, you know, there was, I think it's Platonic, that there's a chariot. Our reason is directing the chariot, you know, and then there's our spirit and there's our will. But you want to get your will in line with your reason. So you want to identify, okay, this is might be what I want. This might be pleasurable, or this might make me feel good or whatever, give me power, but I ought to do this. And so how can I will the thing that I ought to will? And then through that process of that habit of virtue, you begin to have an affection for the good, right? You begin to actually desire the good. You know, this is how we become self-governing, self-ruling individuals.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we will continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Noel Mehring. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of Awake, Not Woke, a Christian response to the cult of progressive ideology by Noel Mehring. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI. Again, that's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website, equip.org, equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. Breaking the code of the Book of Revelation has become an international obsession. The result has been rampant misreading of Scripture, bad theology, and even bad politics and foreign policy. In the Apocalypse Code, find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. Hank Hanegraaff argues that the key to understanding the last book of the Bible is the other 65 books of the Bible, not current events or recent history. The Apocalypse Code offers sane answers to some very controversial questions, such as, what does it mean to take the book of Revelation literally? Who are the Antichrist and the Great Whore of Babylon? And what is the real meaning of 666? Order the Apocalypse Code by Hank Hanegraaff today. Available in softcover, MP3 CD, or MP3 download from equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI.